talk a little bit about your background and how you got into looking at this issue of juveniles in prison.
I'm a documentary or experimental documentary filmmaker for quite some time, and I actually wound up interested in prisons overall almost by chance. I was working in Palestine in refugee camps there, and one of the protagonists of a project that I was focusing on there has spent over 15 years under the Israeli military's incarceration as a prisoner, political prisoner there. And when I moved to the U.S., in part as a result of that project, I was living in California at the time, and I was I found a job listing working teaching video at the prisons there, and I was just intrigued. I thought it would be a way for me to understand his experience more in depth. And of course, the type of situation that I encountered had nothing to do with his background and the kind of strife that he was going through. But it opened up a door and a curiosity into a different issue altogether. And then I got a job at the University of Michigan several years later. Part of the reason I took that job was that I knew that they had a very strong prison creative arts program there. And I joined the program and started working with my students, making videos in a prison there, and then on my own collaborating with a youth that I heard in a poetry reading session that was organized by that program, and really loved the poetry that he was writing. And so I joined him to create a short animation that we both conceived and collaborated for over 2 years in making. And then I moved to Chicago for another job at the Art Institute here, and he was sentenced to life without parole. He was already about 7 or 8 years inside by the time I met him, and I felt that it was time for me to address that issue, in part because I felt wrong leaving him behind and moving on, you know, after we finished that project. And I felt that instead of staying within the experiment, move to something that is slightly more mainstream, try to open up and discuss the issue, and maybe actually impact legislation change around that topic. And so I approached Deb LaBelle, who I knew, she's a civil rights lawyer, and I knew that she was dealing with this issue in part. I didn't know to what extent, and I found out that she was actually representing all 350 youth in Michigan, 350 out of the 2,500 overall nationally. And she was representing them, trying to change the law with respect to their own sentencing. And so she opened her doors to me, helped me financially. She just received a grant from the Ford Foundation that had a portion within it that was supposed to be invested in a video on this issue. And so we just bonded, and she linked me with, she basically showed me the files of many of the people that she was representing, helped me connect with them after I chose the ones that I wanted to focus on, and we just started a project that, again, had its own life and kind of went in a direction that I didn't anticipate entering it.
How did you select which inmates you wanted to focus on?
So Deb LaBelle kind of spread, I think, 20 or so files on a large desk, and that's what I started off with, looking at different stories and looking for both somewhat of a statistic representation of the, or at least a representation that would incorporate the various differences, for instance, in the age the kids were arrested, in gender, race, background, etc. And so I narrowed down the selection to, I think, about 10 or 15 And then I interviewed over the phone those people that seemed interesting, both in terms of the story and, again, as part of that diversity that I was seeking. And within those, I selected in the end were the stories that were mostly told in the most unique way and most intriguing way, that something about the character would touch me more than others. The story felt more specific in the way it was told or analyzed by the person I was talking with. And so in the end, it was really based on those people that moved me, or their storytelling felt most idiosyncratic and interesting. And so I still kept to somewhat of diverse distribution in terms of the age and race and gender, but not as precise as maybe I started off with.
And I noticed that a lot of these teens were either not directly responsible for the crimes they committed, or their culpability is somewhat in question, these characters that you picked out. Is that common for these juvenile lifers?
Yeah, that is common, apparently. And I found that afterwards, part of the diversity that I was seeking was a degree of responsibility. And I found out that many of the ones that I was talking with were just there with an adult, that they didn't stop from committing a crime, and not stopping the adult constitute aiding and abetting. You need to actually actively stand up to the person who is committing the crime or leave the room, which I think is ironic in the context of the age gap. Sometimes the gender gap, a girl with a boyfriend that would commit the crime and she didn't stop him, or he would use her in some way or another to facilitate the crime, bring the person in if it was for an act of prostitution, and then kill the man. And so, yes, that what I found, and especially I think with the women, is that oftentimes it wasn't them that committed the crime directly. And then I went the whole spectrum. There is one story where the youth did admit and take full responsibility over the crime. Another where the youth would only admit to enabling a murder that he didn't directly commit, two aiders and abettors, and then the fifth person that I talked to is claiming innocence and feels like he was actually framed. So the whole spectrum is there.
You know, when they commit a crime like this, should we put them in prison? If we do, how long should they remain there? What should we do?
I don't know if I'm the person qualified to say what we should do, but I think what we should at least address is the fact that they're youth, and that youth is scientifically proven to be operating differently. They still don't have the ethics stand that we as solidified as adults. They work they can operate more impulsively. They're much more liable to have peer pressure activate some of their behavior. They are not capable mentally of understanding future consequences to the extent that we do. So they're psychologically different. And I think that means that we should address their crime differently and take into account their capacity for change and growing up and maturing and stepping out of the state that they operated from within. So they should be judged as youth. And that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be sentenced, and maybe sometimes sentenced severely, but they should be examined individually as youth. Their circumstances should be taken into account. Many of them come from backgrounds that were in different ways insufficient, either economically, or there was no adult role model to emulate. There was no standard to follow. Many times it's abusive homes, sexually or other forms of violence, or just neglect of sorts. And all of that is not taken into account. Basically, once they are charged as adults, and the prosecutor in Michigan specifically, the prosecutor can decide if which way they're charged. If they're charged as adults and found guilty, up to a few years ago, the judge was not able to sentence them in any way other than for life without parole. So I think the mechanism should change at its different points, and kind of the automated structure, both at the front end with a prosecutor and charging them as adults, and the judge sentencing them in one way. Both of these should be opened up for conversation and made discreet.
Nationally, we're trying to get away from sentencing juveniles for life, but in Michigan, this is still very much an issue. And, you know, why is it, do you believe, that Michigan has one of the highest numbers of juvenile lifers?
Actually, I don't know why Michigan is up there. I mean, there are a few other states that are as well, but definitely Michigan is one of the highest. And I don't know what makes it harsher. Partly it's maybe problematic with a prosecutor right to charge as an adult and kind of waive the kid before they're checked for specific background or individual context. It's up to the prosecutor rather than the judge to decide on how they're going to be sentenced or charged. And that's specific to Michigan and a few other states. And in Michigan specifically, there was no... Two years ago, the Supreme Court actually ruled that discretion is returned to the judge and that no kid should be automatically sentenced for life without parole, even if found guilty of first-degree murder. In Michigan, this is all still negotiated, and nationally, the retroactive component of this is still negotiated for those 2,500 kids that were sentenced before the law, the Supreme Court ruling came into being. So many states have ruled that it is retroactive, and so these kids are resentenced or examined again. But in Michigan, this is still up in the air, and as of now, not yet reversed.
In a previous interview, you said that the media actually had a lot to do with intensifying these sentences for youth, especially in the 80s and 90s. Talk about that a little bit.
So in the late 80s, there was a big case that I think many of us remember in Central Park in New York, where several youth were accused of a murder of a woman and a rape. It was all actually proven to be wrong very recently, but at the time it set in motion a media frenzy around the treatment of youth in general, and they were described as in terms like predator and super predator. Academics were talking about it. The police was and the legal entities were responding to that kind of rise in outrageous behavior by youth, and a lot of it was not based in fact. It was really just swirling out of control by media response to that event and a few other events around it. A lot of those statements were revised over the years, but at the time they did impact the way the legal system responded, and much more harsh legal sentencing laws and charging laws came into effect, and those are not yet revised, or they're just beginning to be addressed right now, even though a lot of the facts are already proven, or the statistics that were then circulated are already proven to be misleading.
a lot of these kids are talking about what they're missing. If they could only have known, you know, what to do in that situation, that they could have been living a normal life. I just found that very compelling.
I think part of what I'm trying to advocate in the piece is seeing, understanding that change is what they undergo, and oftentimes change that is radical from a kid that is lost and maybe misdirected to an adult that is remorseful, that is educated, thoughtful, and that would never commit a crime like that again. And so I was looking for ways to manifest that kind of growth through the interviews with them.
This could be costly, what we're doing in Michigan, keeping all of these juvenile lifers in prison.
Right. I think if nothing else, if empathy isn't the thing that moves you, and an understanding of the difference between adults and youth, I think financially it's taking a huge toll. These kids are funded for life, and they come in very young by us. And I don't remember the exact figures, but it's many, many tens of thousands a year per kid. And from age 15, 16, 17 until the end of their life, we're funding their life in prison. So financially, this is a mistake beyond, again, the more urgent argument that I'm making on the moral front.
And you've actually set up a Kickstarter for an extension of the project, focusing on the story of Efren Paredes, who is actually from our area, St. Joseph, Michigan. Can you talk about his story a little bit?
So I can't talk about it too much in depth. We're still working on looking at the story at this point. But Efren is claiming that he actually never committed the crime. And so his story kind of is slightly different than some of the other stories that I was addressing in Natural Life. And we decided, myself and my partner in this second iteration of the project, to address his claims and see what we can find out about the specifics of his crime and his claim. Part of the problem with his claim for innocence is that even if he gets to be resentenced, and examined again for parole, one of the conditions for parole is that you express remorse, and he's refusing to express remorse because he's claiming that he didn't commit the crime, and so he's kind of trapped in a catch-22, which the legal system is not really addressing. What do you do with those people that are not willing to express remorse, not because they haven't grown, but because they claim that they didn't have the responsibility or that they didn't actually do the action that they're charged with? And so we're trying to look at all of those aspects of his case.
Can you describe why you called it Natural Life?
So Natural Life is the legal term for life without parole. That's the same, it has the same meaning. If you're sentenced for life without parole, which means that you're going inside no matter how old you are for the rest of your life, and you're never examined for change or growth, you're in for the rest of your life until you die. That is called Natural Life, and I was using it somewhat ironically by examining the life that they're leading inside.
Is there anything else that I didn't ask or anything that you think that you should mention about the film?
Maybe just one thing that does come up in conversations after the screening. The film is structured as a two-sided, a split screen. And people oftentimes want to know why. And part of the rationale behind this kind of two views is to enable difference to be part of the argument. The sentence is overlooking difference. It's basically applied in the same way to all the kids, not looking at the different types of backgrounds, different degrees of guilt, different causes that brought them there. And so what I wanted to do is address multiplicity overall and propose that that should be part of the way we examine these cases. And so the two sides of the screen just tackle the stories in inconsistent ways. So sometimes the left is the legal system and the right would be the victim, and sometimes it's flipped. And then there's the police and the various people that surround the inmate, either family or friends, the legal aid, the community at large. And so all of those various sides flip between those sides of the stories, and hopefully the suggestion of multiple perspectives comes across.
Right. It was also an interesting idea for the installation that you had as well.
Right. Right. That is still in play right now at the Museum of Contemporary Art of Detroit till the end of March, and also at a gallery here in Chicago. So hopefully the show in various forms, either as a single channel piece or in the installation format, will be moving around the nation and stirring conversation. That's really what the piece was designed to do. And there's also an interactive archive that will be up and running by mid-May and will allow you to hear the stories in more depth and less edited version.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. We can expect to see your film at Saffron in Kalamazoo on March 6th. It's called Natural Life, and check out our website for more information.
Thank you so much.